As you know, in addition to those who are sick today, we have individuals who have just gotten out of the hospital, individuals who aren't feeling well, but we do also have some who are out of town. I think that the Carrolls, I saw Zoe here, so she stayed behind, but I know that that Justin is out of town at the death of his grandmother, attending the funeral, and I do believe that Albert and Miranda are probably out of town as well. I think on Wednesday they indicated that they wanted to go down and to help his mother. His mother, of course, has not been faithful for a while, but the grandmother, his grandmother, Albert's grandmother, decided that she wanted to hear about this Church of Christ and this preacher, and she was convinced on the Sunday that she went to services that she needed to be baptized, and was. And the mother went with her. So that was the first time she had been in church for quite a while. And she, as a babe in Christ, misunderstood a little bit of what the preacher was asking her. He was asking her if she was convinced of her conversion. She had come back, and it had been such a short period of time since she had departed the church that he wanted to make sure that she felt okay and that she was willing to start coming back again and all, and she thought that he told her she had to be rebaptized. And she wasn't going to do that because she'd already been baptized. She didn't need to. So that caused a little bit of confusion. Albert was able to straighten it out, but I think they went down there to go back with the mother to the services and just give their support to her, which is a good thing. So there are several who are out of town for those kinds of reasons and traveling, and we do want you to pray that they return home safely. And those who are ill and not able to be here, that we ask for God's providential care on them as well. We are to Acts chapter 25 in our study. Acts chapter 25, we'll read some of this in just a few moments' time, continuing Paul's dealing with both Jews and Romans while imprisoned there in Caesarea prior to his departure by boat to Rome to receive judgment from Caesar himself in the appeal that was made, that actually that appeal is stated here in this particular text. So we'll talk about that in a few moments. As always, I want to go back and offer some review from the previous chapter, which details the trial that the Apostle Paul received, first by Felix. And that really didn't accomplish much because Felix was a politician. And Felix didn't really do anything with the information that he had received. But you'll remember that the leaders were brought up to Caesarea. The Roman garrison had taken Paul and given him some protection as he went to Caesarea Maritime from Jerusalem, which is not a very long distance at all. But it was requested that the Sanhedrin, or leaders from the Sanhedrin, come. Well, the Sanhedrin are the leaders, but individuals from the Sanhedrin come and to bring their charges against the Apostle Paul so that Felix could hear them. And what they did was allow an orator named Tertullus, a very charismatic individual, no doubt, an individual who was good at laying down cases to bring evidence against Paul. And there wasn't any evidence, really, concerning the charges that they were making. And this is identified both with regard to Felix. It's also identified with Festus and Agrippa. All three of them recognized that this was just a matter of between the Jews with regard to the interpretation of their religion and who this Jesus Christ was. And they really didn't know whether it was worthy of anything. They thought, according to the laws that they were governing by and such, nothing worthy of death had been accomplished. And yet the Jews were steadfast in wanting him to be dead. So Paul gave his defense before Felix, denied the accusations, asserted the reason he was accused was because of his association with the way and his belief in the resurrection, which of course was a big part of this. And so Felix acted like a politician. He knew that Paul should not should be let go, but Paul wanted to do the Jews a favor. We're told in chapter 24 and verse 27 that 2 years passed before Porcius Festus succeeded Felix. So 2 years had passed. We're told that Felix wanted to receive a bribe to let him go. All of these things going on, and did nothing with Paul for this two-year period of time. Just kept him in prison there in Caesarea. until such time as Festus was coming on. And the last thing Felix could have done, or one of the last things that he could have done, you've heard that with regard to presidents in our own culture, that the last thing that most presidents do, these lame duck presidents, before they leave office, is offer up pardons of individuals. And that could have happened with regard to Paul, but Felix wanted to do the Jews a favor, and so he left Paul bound, as indicated in verse 27 of the text. And so now Paul became Festus a problem. So Porcius Festus took the place of Paul. And that gets us to chapter 25. And we're going to start off in our discussion of this by looking at the first five verses, because here we have recorded for ourselves another plot that has been hatched to kill Paul. So it didn't work with Felix. Didn't work with the commander Lysias with regard to hearing the attempts that were going to be made to when he went from Jerusalem to Caesarea to kill him. So now here's another opportunity with another individual who may not know what's going on. And so we're told that when Festus had come to the province, after 3 days he went from Caesarea to Jerusalem. So 3 days time as the new governor, he's already going to the most prominent town in his province to meet with the Jewish leaders. And when the high priest and the chief men of the Jews informed him against Paul, they petitioned him, asking a favor against him and or of him. So this is, again, an indication of politics. I just wanted to make note of that, because these kinds of things happen all the time in every nation. Is that, okay, this is a new guy, let's ask a favor of him. He's going to want to do us a favor. And so they have a desire that they want to be fulfilled. It is an interesting thing how big a thorn in their side Paul was. How significant a thing was this happened. 2 years had passed. He was imprisoned, and they wanted, I guess they were maybe afraid that Festus would let him go or whatever. They still wanted him dead after this 2 year period of time. So what they did is they had a plot in verse 3. They asked a favor against him that he would summon him to Jerusalem. So he's in Jerusalem with them. They wanted Porcius Festus just to send Paul just over to Jerusalem, and we'll take care of him. That's kind of what they wanted to do. But again, they lay an ambush along the road to kill him. So it was going to be an ambush, not a trial that would be offered for his life. So you see on this particular occasion, there's no indication that Festus knew what was going on. It was simply maybe he had a little more backbone than Felix. Maybe he had a little bit of gumption as to what should be done. So he said no. He answered that Paul should be kept at Caesarea, that he himself was going there shortly, and said, "You come to us. Those of you who has authority, come among you. Go down with me and accuse the man to see if there is any fault in him." Now, one thing that I'm sure that Festus knew at this point in time, that Paul was a Roman citizen. This is something that was evident. And so as a result of that, he wasn't going to just give him, even though he's a Jew too, he wasn't going to just give him over to the Jews. There were rights that Roman citizens had, so they're going to have to come to him, and he was going to be the one to make the decision as to what would be done with the Apostle Paul. And that gets us to, of course, as I always do, I already answered the question. So what is the answer to the question? Why did the high priest ask Festus to bring Paul down to Jerusalem? What was it for? Killing. Okay. So yeah, it's to lay that ambush that we alluded to in the text. And there's, in these particular passages, there are interesting things to talk about from chapter 22 on, I guess, to the end. But this is basically a detailed record of the life of the Apostle Paul from Jerusalem till the time that he goes to Rome. And so there's not a lot of teaching that is done here. There's just explanation of these things. So if there is anything that you do not understand or any question that you have about any of this, please ask. But we're not going to be talking about doctrine quite as much today and talking more about just the circumstances of his defense to Festus and Agrippa and those kinds of things in chapters 25 and 26. Okay, so the second section of our study has to do with the false accusations that are again raised against Paul before Festus, where Paul again had to defend himself. How many times has he defended himself? He defended himself to the mob. He defended himself to Lysias. He defended himself to Felix. He defended himself to the Sanhedrin. He's having continually to to defend himself. Now accusations raised against him. And an interesting thing about this, and this is something that happens with regard to criminals today, is that the efforts to cross-examine, to look at testimony that was stated before and compare it to testimony that is present, is to find changes in argument or changes in circumstances or contradictions with regard to what you said before and what you said after. And they may be small things. And they may be simply because of a lack of memory or because of confusion or whatever the case may be. And it may not be in any way an indication of overt guilt. And yet it is used by prosecution to try to establish or to prove innocence. I mean, a guilt in this particular matter, whatever it may be. And so contradictions would indicate to us that there is something about Paul's defense and his actions that are indefensible, that may indicate that their accusations are true, but there weren't any inconsistencies. You'll see it again in verse 6. When he had remained among them more than 10 days, he went down to Caesarea. That's, of course, talking about Festus. The next day he sat on the judgment seat and commanded Paul to be brought. And when he had come, the Jews who had come down from Jerusalem stood about. They laid many serious complaints against Paul, which they could not prove. And while he answered for himself, neither against the law of the Jews, nor against the temple, nor against Caesar, have I offended in anything at all. So that's a very concise statement in contrast to what we have seen before in these. But he was consistent in saying that I have not done anything wrong. The only reason that he was being judged is because he believed in the resurrection and that Jesus was the cause of the resurrection from the dead, which is something that the Jews and especially the Sadducees and the Sanhedrin would not accept. So with that in mind, what was the characteristic of all the complaints the Jews raised against him? Not only that they were unprovable, but what? They were false. They didn't actually happen the way the Jews were saying that they happened. He had not been a plague. He had not incited. He had not caused a resurrection. He had not desecrated the temple. All of those things that he was claimed to be guilty of, he had not done. He was fulfilling a portion of the law when he was accosted by the Jews on that occasion, and he was doing it for the purpose of showing to the Jews that he did not find the law odious, that he was indeed one who observed the law as a Jew. And of course, it was maybe a misunderstanding. It was maybe that in part they had their minds that they were going to get him anyway, but the claims that were made against him absolutely were false on this occasion. He had done nothing wrong. And of course, when we think about it, the rest of the Jews, the Jewish Christians, excuse me, when Saul was guilty of persecuting them and consenting to their deaths and getting letters from Jerusalem to go to Damascus and bring others bound, they had done nothing wrong either. But Paul was guilty of saying that he must do these things because they were a sect that were, in effect, in his view, unlawful and worthy of death. And so I think perhaps he can see their side of it, but he had done absolutely nothing wrong. So the characteristic was that they were unprovable and they were untrue. You'll notice on this occasion they didn't go into bringing witnesses. No witnesses were available. No one saw him in the temple with a Gentile. Paul done nothing to violate that law. So that's an important thing to consider, and it is consistent with regard to all the defenses that he offered up to the Jews on this particular occasion. Okay? Again, if I'm going a little too quickly, let me know, and we will slow down. But this is pretty much straightforward events. Verses 9 through 12. Now we get back into politics. And so here in verse 9, Paul was a Roman citizen, and this is where he makes his appeal, because on this occasion, in verse 9, we are told that Festus wanted to do the Jews a favor. So think about this. So here is a Roman governor who comes in, and he knows he's got a Roman citizen in jail. And the Jews say, he's a Jew, let him come to us. And they were laying wait for him. He said, no, he's a Roman, so you come to him, and we'll make sure of what needs to go on. Well, he was a Jew, though, wasn't he? And what he's talking about, these are things that Festus had no awareness of. So, well, maybe this man, Paul, would be willing to be judged by the Jews. And that would get it off my plate and would give the Jews what they want. And so he wanting to do the Jews a favor, it didn't matter to him. He could care less. We are told there in verse 9, he answered Paul and said, "Are you willing?" There is some significance to this. Are you willing? He's a Roman citizen here, so he has rights. And so basically he was saying, in the parlance of the day, are you willing to waive your right to be tried by me and go back to Jerusalem and be tried by the Jews, or judged before, to go up to Jerusalem and there be judged before me concerning these things? So he's going to let the Jews have a lead. Now he makes the final decision, of course, but take it to Jerusalem. That's where they wanted it to be. And that's when Paul made his appeal to Caesar. Paul said, "I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. To the Jews I have done no wrong, as you very well know, for I am an offender. If I'm an offender or have committed anything deserving of death, I don't object to dying. But if there is nothing in these things of which they may accuse me, no one can deliver me to them." And then he says, "I appeal to Caesar." We've talked about this a number of times, and I haven't really done a deep study on this as to what significance or how it always accomplished. I just know what happened with regard to Paul. As a Roman citizen, he had the right. And it seems that all Roman citizens would have the right to appeal to Caesar for judgment. That was kind of the ultimate thing. It's kind of like our Supreme Court. And there are mechanisms with limitations as to what you can go through if you're being judged. And you can ask to be seen by the Supreme Court, or your particular trial to be heard by the Supreme Court. So they're the final adjudication in our land. Now, there are a couple of things about the Supreme Court that we'll note the parallels with Caesar. And that is, number one, the Supreme Court can refuse to hear you. So they can say, "Nah, it's not worth it." And that's why there's not many really insignificant trials that go to the Supreme Court, because they only hear the important ones, or the ones that that will either impact further jurisprudence or perhaps impact the society or whatever the case may be. Same thing with Caesar. What you have here is an emperor. And if he didn't want to see Paul, he didn't have to see Paul. Paul was there for 2 years before there was any indication that Caesar had anything to do with him there in Rome. And so also, because this is not the Supreme Court bound by law, the emperor was his own law. So if he burned his toast that morning, you could be executed as a result of that. So it was a risky thing for Paul to do. But he knew what his end was in Jerusalem. He knew what would happen if he went to Jerusalem, or at least the potential of what would happen. And he also knew that it was God's intent for him to go to Rome. And one surefire way for him to get to Rome is make that appeal to Caesar. If I appeal to Caesar and the governor doesn't let me go to Caesar, he is basically being disobedient to Roman law. And he's violating his rights as a Roman citizen. And so he made his appeal to Caesar. Now, there's no indication this pleased Festus. Can you imagine a brand new governor, and the first thing that happens to him in this short period of time he's governor is, "Oh no, I've got to let a prisoner go and have to burden Caesar with this." And he didn't even know what was going on, because that's why he brought King Agrippa into this. "I don't know what to tell Caesar." And so it was not an easy thing. But you'll notice he said, when he had conferred with the council, he answered, he said, "You've appealed to Caesar. To Caesar you shall go." And I imagine that probably Festus is saying, "That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard for anyone to do, because you're gonna regret it. But you're going. You want to go, you can go." And is out of his hands. And so there is that that happened on this occasion. Now, here's a question that maybe was not directly referenced. It alluded to in our text. But what would have happened to Paul if he had not appealed to Caesar for judgment? And I'm thinking maybe that this is, verse 9. Yeah, it happened there in verse 9 when Festus asked. So that's the reference in verse 9 of the text. And then I don't know what 26 and 32 tells us, that Agrippa said to Festus, the man might have been set free if he had not appealed to Caesar. So those are the two references. That may have happened. They were laying in wait as an ambush, or wanted to lay in wait for that part. So what do you think would have happened? This is not a certainty, but what do you think would have happened to Paul if he had gone back to Jerusalem?
No. The Lord had already told him, "You must appear in Rome." So he knew he was going to Rome.
Okay.
I've been tempted in the past to accuse Paul. I don't think I did it publicly, just in my own mind. And he was helping the Lord by making his appeal. No. because we don't know what else the Lord told him. We're only told just to spend it in that conversation. You know, the Lord talked to him longer than that. I think that was the plan. He says, when this happens, you appeal, and you go to Rome. And that's how I will get you to Rome.
Okay.
But it's evident that the Jews were planning to kill him. They were like, wait. It's evident that Festus, having said that, at first he'll stand Caesar, changed his mind and said, in order to please them, he would try to get him down there. He even asked Paul if he would go. They would lay wait for him and try to kill him. They didn't have Lysias with all his wardens.
Yeah. Well, he had a lot that protected him the first time, didn't he?
I don't think that's his character. He would have died.
Yeah. Oh, I don't
either. He'd have been fine just to let him die. And he lied. And because when he spoke here later in the chapter, he tells Agrippa the reason why is because I wanted you to, please.
Yeah, I think that's politics is what that was. I was going to make that point. Yeah, yeah. That's a good point. Yeah. I wasn't thinking that way. I was like you as far as that goes. It's just we of course know the providence of God is involved in this. For one, he wasn't going back to Jerusalem because of God's providence. That's certainly the case. But just note that that the statement made by Agrippa in Acts 26 and verse 32 was not an accurate statement, that he might have been let go if he hadn't appealed to Caesar. This was the intention from the beginning, and they only had negative and deleterious motives towards Paul, so it wouldn't have been something that would have allowed him to be released if he were to return back. Paul was doing exactly what he intended to do. Now I don't even know how I answered it, but he would have been judged. Indications are Festus wouldn't have been fair. See, this is just a supposition that I was talking about here, but it's all irrelevant, again, as Dennis said, because of the fact that God's providence is what was supplying these things. And so it's almost what we might say a moot point, I guess. Maybe a question that's not necessary in that regard because of what was indeed what did happen, and it happened at God's direction. So that's certainly goodness to come to mind. But he was, of course, always... I wouldn't even say he was in danger since God had directed this, but there were always the oppression, the efforts to kill Paul because of their hatred of him. And so going back to the Jews was not going to accomplish anything at all for Paul and his ministry. And that's the point we wanted to make. Yes? Yes.
We saw last hour, Philippians chapter 1, the reason why the Lord wanted him to go to Rome, didn't
we? Yeah, we did.
It wasn't to save his life, to rescue him from danger. He wanted him to live and preach.
Yeah.
The 2 years he was there.
And not only he was effective in his preaching, but if you read the entirety of that book, those who preach some out of strife and some to add to his chains, but others because of sincerity and such, the gospel was preached strongly there as a result of his being there by others as well. So it was a very prolific opportunity that was had, and the church in Rome was established as a result of efforts such as these to proclaim the gospel. So it was an important thing to be done in this center of the known world there in Rome itself, that there was a church that was established as a result of all these things. Sure. No, that's fine. No, appreciate it. I like it. I like it. We're going through too quick anyway.
Paul was never in danger. The Lord protected him for his entire life. He suffered plenty. And the Lord never promised us that he would suffer. He had a mission. Paul also, Paul is going to complete that mission. Those 2 years he spent in Rome, he was not in danger. He had his mission yet. Yeah. The Lord had a mission for him. He said in 2 Timothy, he was talking to Brother Mike Kennedy, he says, now I complete my mission. I've run the race. I've gained. And the Lord's standing of Paul was a gift to him.
It certainly was. And that's indicated from Philippians 1 as well.
The only reason he didn't want to go is because my vision hadn't completed yet. Well, my vision was done. I fought a good fight. I'm ready to go. And that was it.
Yeah. I would point out, because the application can be made to us as well, is that we don't have the same overt communications from God as to what is in our future, like the Apostle Paul did. So we can't be assured that each day progresses, which is one of the reasons why we are given the responsibility to accept and receive our salvation while it is today, not sometime in the future, not to be arrogant about these things. Paul, of course, wasn't arrogant in any way. But it was something that is true. He was never in danger. However, Paul was not always aware that he was not in danger. Again, he was assured of it. He knew it at the end of his life that, okay, it's been done and now I may be taken or will be taken at any time. But you do remember in Philippians chapter 1, with regard to Paul's first imprisonment, he thought that his mission would continue. He said to be remain with you is more needful, but to depart is far better. He said, I'm confident that I'll remain. But it seems in the language used is that he wasn't 100% certain that he would be let go. And it wasn't because he didn't know what Caesar was going to do. He didn't know what the Lord was going to have him to do, is I think ultimately. So Paul did not have a full understanding from day one until the end of his life what each day was going to bring and how long he would live. But having said that, the Lord knew. And that's what Dennis is referring to with regard to God's providential care. It was only until that work was done, which Paul did become aware of, that, yeah, it's done now, that he would for sure remain alive. And then once it was done, he knew that the end was near. And I would think probably because, as we alluded to, now that this second imprisonment had come and he had no assurances and he saw what the tenor of the day was and all that his work had been done and accomplished, all the things God had given him to do, so it was probable that he was going to die very quickly. I don't know that there's anything in Timothy that said, okay, it's going to be on this day or this is going to happen immediately, but he said, the time of my departure is at hand, though. So he knew what was going on at that point in his life. I just want to kind of make that distinction known. We're talking a lot about God's providence, but we're pointing things out about circumstances of physical life like we have. If God has a plan for me to remain alive for a period of time, then I'm not in danger either. But I don't know that for sure. So I don't know exactly what's going to happen to me because it has been revealed to me, like it was to Paul. Yes?
Well,
yeah, I think so too. I don't think I think that's an indication, again, that he was touched by what Paul was saying. I don't think it was just being satirical or in any way inappropriate in those words. One thing I do want to note, and again, it's something that we've already discussed from Acts the 17th chapter, but I would like you to turn back there and just note one thing. When we're talking about God's working in the affairs of men, with the distinction being made between then and now, is there are times when God certainly worked miracles at this point in time. We have the miraculous gifts. We had the ministry of Jesus. We had the apostles who had the ability to lay on hands, those kinds of things. And people will talk about, okay, a difference in the way things happen today than what they happened before. And we don't have the same assurances or the same, we don't have the same awareness. Because when we talk about, for example, miracles, primarily the purpose of miracles, I mean, they accomplished much good, but the primary purpose was to prove that the men who performed them were for God. And so we don't need any supplemental revelation in order for us to know when a miracle has happened. So if I have an ability to turn water into wine, I have the ability to raise someone from the dead, I have the ability to a withered hand be restored or leprosy be removed, those kinds of things. That's an indication that I am from God. And that's what the apostles had, that's what Jesus had. And it was proof, overt proof. And that was the purpose of miracles. Now the age of miracles has ceased, as 1 Corinthians 13 tells us. The concept of God's providence, which Rule alluded to that we have, ceasing is not accurate. And God's providence was used and utilized in the time of Jesus as well, in the time of the apostles as well. So we have providence, and in addition to that, miracles. But today we just have providence. So that's how there is a difference. But what I would like to explain providence is to recognize that providence is supernatural as well. It is simply not a miracle, which is the setting aside of natural law to accomplish in some unnatural or supernatural way this action. That's what a miracle is. And that doesn't happen today, but God still works in the affairs of men. And that's what's indicated here in Acts chapter 17, when we are told in the address that Paul gave in the Areopagus, beginning in verse, verse 26 of the text. So he said he's not worshipped with men's hands as though he needs anything. He gives everyone life and breath and all things. But he's made from one blood every nation under heaven to dwell on all the face of the earth, and he has determined their pre-appointed times and the boundaries of their dwellings so that they should seek the Lord and find him, though he's not far from each of us. So this is a determination under the new covenant, the way it is now, that God continues to work in the affairs of men. And the fact that prayer exists is another extremely strong argument that God still works in the affairs of men. So when we pray that God heal someone, God providentially can heal. It is not uncommon, for example, for cancer to go into remission or someone to have a strong immune system and overcome their illness a bit more quickly, or a lot of different kind of things that we're talking about that can be directed, not in a supernatural way, but not a miraculous way, by God. And so we recognize God determines events. I've often alluded to the fact, and always fearing that someone may disagree with me, but that God had a hand in my coming here rather than going to another place all the way back in 1989 when I became a member of this congregation and a preacher here. And so I think God directed my life. Now I don't have anything written by the Lord. I don't have any direct revelation that these things happened. It was God supernaturally working in my life to accomplish a particular good, and I believe that to be the case. But because it was a providential thing rather than a miraculous thing, I don't have anything except anecdotal testimony to say that that's what had happened. And that's the way providence works. And so we don't have the same thing supplied as, for example, Paul did on this occasion. And I think that with regard to Paul, miraculous things could happen. Also, providential things could happen. And God said, this is the way it's going to happen. And this can be accomplished. But there are differences between the first century and the things that went on and what is going on today. But that doesn't change at all that God has a part to play in our lives and directs our lives. And maybe God is the one who determines when our life is going to be over, for whatever reason it may be, or whether we're going to just live to a good old age, whatever reason it may be. And so we don't know God's will beyond what is written for us. But we do trust that he is one who cares for us, and that it is appointed for man to die once, and after this the judgment, and so death is the end of all men, but that prayer does do good, and prayer helps. And that's where we leave it, and what we can do with that. Yes, Rule?
To be fair to say that the providence of God is the beginning of the earth, the end of the earth.
Oh, yes, very much so.
Miracles were done, just like you said, in order to set his purpose in a miraculous way to show that he is God. Even when you said this is the real, these are good things that are happening. Show that this is what happened.
That's good. Yeah, well, we can prove it by the Bible, but you're right, we can't. Yeah, no, I get you. That's the problem, because when you ask the world, when the world asks you, did God have a hand in it, you say, yes, I believe that he did. Well, you can't prove it. And so the world doesn't believe it.
That's the point,
Yeah. What scripture says. Yeah, I had to come across that recently in that Thursday Bible study, because they ask those kinds of questions. Is how do you know? I said, well, because the scripture says so. But is there anything else? How do you know? No, I trust. I trust that God said he would, and he does. And I'm sorry if that doesn't prove it to you. But all these other miracles that were performed, given by eyewitness testimony in the past, should prove it to you as well. And so God's working in our lives today is something that we accept by faith. Yes?
You said something a while ago, and I think we're actually saying this, we're just not pinning it down. You said that the providence of God is supernatural, but it's not miraculous.
Yeah, I make that distinction because Justin Carroll said everything that the Lord does, this is way back when, he said everything the Lord does is supernatural. And you're right. It is, because he's outside of nature in that regard.
The reason we don't call it miraculous is because the miracles in the New Testament were signs.
Yeah.
The purpose for those were for the eyewitnesses to see and understand that this is irrefutable evidence of a supernatural occurrence. Even the simple Pharisees, after this, the end of the lay man, said, we cannot deny that a great miracle has been performed. They wouldn't. But they saw that's what makes a miracle. So do miracles happen today? Yes, but we don't call them miracles because no one sees them. A miracle has to be seen. It has to be a sign. Mm-hmm. God doesn't show signs anymore, but he does suspend the laws of God.
Yeah, as far as the, any time you have God interfering or directing or involving himself in the natural progression of events, that by definition is supernatural. He is moving things around to where things happen. And so God does still work in the natural world today and set aside what would happen for his will and what does happen. But we're, again, talking about miracles or signs would be this direct, not an indirect, providential intervention, but a direct intervention to where there is something that is obvious that can be proven simply by the eyewitness testimony that this didn't. I'll just give you just a simple example. Now we've gotten off, and now we're not going to finish, but that's all right. It's good. It's good discussion. It's sometimes more important. But I had a preacher friend of mine when I was very, very young says it, and in some ways it seems to me a miracle that a black cow will eat green grass and give white milk. And of course, there's nothing miraculous about that. It's a natural progression of things. But understanding something, if you had a cow eat green grass and give Kool-Aid, well, that's a miracle. And that's something you don't have to question about it. Cows don't do that. That's something that is miraculous. And a person who's able to make that happen, if it's because of them, then they're from God. Not saying that would ever happen. I'm just saying that's an example of a miracle. And then the other way, which is God working today behind the scenes. Maybe that's the best way of putting it. He's just working behind the scenes. Instead, he still directs us, that he is supernaturally working because he's a divine being outside of nature, but it's not a sign that we can prove. It's simply him doing as he wills in his creation, and we accept that that's the case. Yes, Chris.
Sometimes we see Paul staying silent, allowing things to happen to him. Sometimes he speaks up like he does here, and absent, as it has been said, he obviously had information exactly how much that maybe influenced some of the choices. But absent that, like you said, with Providence, sometimes we don't know.
No, I got you.
Sometimes when we look and like, okay, I've got two, three, four choices to make here. Which one should I do? Wednesday night, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how to know how to make choices.
Uh-huh.
And I know one of the things that people are struggling with, myself included, it is what is the optimal choice? Which way? God obviously has a path for me. And if I don't choose that one, then somehow I'm going outside of God's will. But when we think about the way providence works, it's if I look and I see that these things are available. I can do each of these in a godly way, and I make a choice, and I do it in a godly way. The providence is that God will, you sow the seed by doing something godly, and then God works
his
providence
sure.
to help that bear fruit. It's not that God has a way chosen out. He might, and if he does, then it doesn't matter. Yeah. But as long as what we do and choose, we do and choose.
Yeah, a lot of times people take predestination and bring it into providence, and there's really no place for it there at all. I do want to just very quickly, since we only have just a minute or two left, note through the rest of it. We're not going to read it all, but the next section is Festus talking with Herod Agrippa, playing politics again. He wants Agrippa in on it, and also his wife Bernice about Paul's case when the king was there to meet and welcome him. He pointed out the Jews' efforts. Accusations were not about wrongdoing, about the religion, and about Jesus. And so Paul made his appeal to Caesar. And then we have the next section that Festus brought Paul before Agrippa at the king's request and desired Agrippa's examination. And he, with pomp and circumstance, showed his political bent there as well in the way he addressed Agrippa, who was the king of the Jews at that time in that region, or the leader of the Jews at that time. And so all of this was going on. And the rationale made by Festus to have Paul examined is, again, Dennis said he was lying because he really didn't care, but he wanted to obtain proper ideas in writing to Caesar about Paul. I do think there may be a little bit of that sense of self-preservation if he were to send Paul to Caesar. He had to have a good reason for it, or Caesar might get upset with him. And then the second, is it unreasonable for a man to be a prisoner without a charge? Yeah. Say, of course it is. There was nothing reasonable about what was going on. As far as how Paul was being treated. He was used by God, of course, to accomplish his purpose. So that gets us down to the end of the chapter. I appreciate very much everyone's kind attention. We started off going too quickly, we started going too slowly, and we finished right on time. I appreciate your kind attention. We're going to pick up with chapter 26 in our study next time.